Okay.
So yeah.
Today we have Filippo Miato.
Thank you. Okay, so today's talk will be concerned in the area of quantum optics. But I will try to possibly make a bridge with quantum information. In particular, the kind of process that we'll talk about is known as spontaneous parametric downconversion. And it's a process that creates entangled pairs of photons. So the kind of entanglement that I will talk about is bipartite entanglement. But it's a high-dimensional entanglement, namely the Hilbert space, where the Schmidt decomposition of this state is hosted, is a particularly high-dimensional space. So I will start by introducing the spatial field modes, because they are basically are the building bricks of the Schmidt decomposition, of the spatial part of the wave function. And then I will introduce orbital angular momentum, which is an observable and a particularly nice one, and I will explain how. Then I will turn my attention to downconversion, and I will explain why there is entanglement in downconversion. Then this is actually a two-faced problem, because we actually have to understand what modes are generated, but we also have to know what modes are have to be detected, so our detection basis. And so this will be linked to the shared information and ultimately the Schmidt modes. And then the meat of the talk will be a series of approximations. So by dropping some approximations, we can have a more general understanding of the Schmidt modes and of the generated state. So I will drop various approximations until we'll have eventually a fairly general description of the state, and I will show what new stuff can be found by dropping the various approximations, and I will end with some nice experiments and nice experimental results that can be achieved with these kind of states. So let's get started with some spatial field modes. It's actually very easy. We start with a scalar wave equation. Then we assume that the solutions are separable in between the spatial and the temporal part. And if we replace then this separated solutions, we get to the Helmholtz equation. If the Helmholtz equation can be solved in a different set of different coordinate systems. And depending on which coordinate system we choose, then we will have solutions which look different and they have different properties. For instance, we can get to the Hankel functions, Bessel functions. If we solve it in elliptic coordinates, we get the Mathieu functions, etc. But there is a fundamental problem with these functions, and it is that they describe fields that are that can be created up to an approximation, and this is because they carry an infinite amount of energy. It's like the plane wave solution of the scalar wave equation. I mean, a plane wave carries an infinite amount of energy and can be it's not an L2 function and can be realized up to an approximation. But we can get around this problem by taking the paraxial approximation, and so we write the solutions in a more convenient way, and then we take the paraxial approximation, which basically tells that we are interested in fields that propagate mainly in one direction. So if we do this, we obtain the paraxial Helmholtz equation. And the good news is that the paraxial Helmholtz equation has physical solutions. And this is because every possible solution to the paraxial Helmholtz equation has a Gaussian envelope, which means that it also has a certain specified width. And it carries a finite amount of energy. So it's a really good tool to describe, for instance, laser beams or higher order modes of laser beams. Like the Helmholtz equation, it can be solved in various different coordinate systems. And depending on the coordinate system, we get a different family of solutions. There is a really high number of different families of solutions, depending on which coordinate system we choose. I think there are more than the ones that I'm listing here. We will not talk about all of them. They all have different properties, and they all are eigenmodes of different observables. But I will concentrate on the Lagerge-Gauss basis. So as soon as we fix a width for these modes, then we get a complete set. A complete set of L2 functions for the plane. How do they look like? Well, they are found if we solve the Parallaxian-Helmholtz equation in polar coordinates. So we have a radial degree of freedom and an azimuthal degree of freedom. And the solutions are separable in these two variables. So we can address the two separately. So let's first address the azimuthal degree of freedom. Every mode is an eigenmode of the orbital angular momentum. And I will talk about the orbital angular momentum in a few minutes. This is the phase structure of these modes. It looks like a corkscrew or a fusilli pasta, if you allow me the comparison. Every mode is associated to, can be labeled by an integer number, which basically tells us how many times the phase crosses 2 pi and goes back to zero as we go around once. It happens once here, 3 times here. So the orbital angular momentum is L times h bar. So here L is 1, here L is 3. If the handedness is on the other side, L takes negative values. At the center of each of these beams, there is a phase singularity. Hence, here this is the amplitude. This is the intensity. And in fact, at the center, you can see there is a darkness, basically. The structure of the radial degree of freedom instead. Here each mode is labeled by, again, an integer number, which ranges from 0 to infinity. And it tells how many times the amplitude crosses 0. So basically, how many dark rings we have radially. We have P equal 4 for both. But L is 1. And in fact, here we have the phase singularity. And here L is 0. So we have no corkscrew. And so we have no phase singularity in the middle. Now, why is orbital angular momentum a good observable? There is a simple reason for this. And it's related to the phase structure. So when we have a mode and a detector, and the detector goes click, we need to be sure of what mode we are detecting. Modes of the orbital angular momentum are always orthogonal to each other for different orbital angular momentum, regardless of the width of the mode. This is because the phase structure was just given by e to the i phi, and so if L is different and we integrate over the angle, we get delta of L minus L prime. So regardless of the width, they are orthogonal. But this doesn't happen for the radial degree of freedom. And if you think of an experiment where a real life experiment where you have lenses with a finite size and mirrors with a finite size and fibers with a finite size, etc., then if you propagate the mode and you have a lens with a finite size, then you automatically cut off some part of the field. But the field that remains is still an eigenfunction of the orbital angular momentum. And this is why orbital angular momentum is particularly well-behaved and it's widely used in experiments. Then down conversion. So that conversion is a process which happens in a crystal, not in every crystal. It depends on the symmetries of the lattice structure of the crystal. So what happens is you have all the atoms arranged in the lattice. And if you shine a laser beam through, a powerful enough laser beam, what happens is that the atoms will feel a force and they will be displaced a bit. And the displacement as a function of the electric field is mainly linear, but it can have a small nonlinear correction. Now, these nonlinear terms in the Hamiltonian basically destroy a photon and create, well, the second order term creates two photons. And energy is conserved, momentum is conserved, and since we cannot know where this happens or when this happens, then we have entanglement. The amplitude of creating a pair along the crystal is constant, and this translated into the far field, which is basically the momentum space, which will give a sinc function. So in the far field, what one sees is a big blob of light in the middle. It will see the intensity, so the square of this function, and secondary rings outside it. Now, the two photons are phase matched, so they have the same phase. But we can introduce a phase mismatch by either tilting the crystal or changing its temperature, depending on the type of crystal. And what happens is that this function, this so-called phase matching function, becomes different. Becomes, for instance, here we don't have intensity in the center. We see basically darkness in the center, and we have a ring around and secondary rings outside it. This is just an example, and we can have nice patterns like this one. This is type 2 down conversion, which means that each of the photons has its own ring, set of rings, and the two rings have opposite polarization. For type 1, there is only one ring with just one polarization. This is a nice way, for instance, to create Bell states, because you can take photons from here and here where they overlap, and you don't know which polarization they have. They can have both, and you get the cross terms, and then you get Bell states. But Bell states have a Schmidt number of 2, so we want to do more. We can do more by addressing the spatial modes and the temporal modes. So if you take the total Hilbert space as the space of spatial modes, of temporal modes, and you also add the two polarizations, then you can create a state in the domain of hyperentangled states, which are states that live in this vast Hilbert space. The question we need to ask and answer is, what does the dimension of this space depend on which parameters, and how can we control them? So we need to basically solve the Schmidt decomposition. So we will look at the spatial part of the wave function, and we seek a decomposition of this kind, where these are the modes that I introduced before. And this is a set of Schmidt weights. We then can apply a measure on these weights. This is the Schmidt number, which basically gives us the dimensionality of the Hilbert space, or the number of effective modes that there are. In principle, this sum goes up to infinity, but some of the modes are more important than others. If you want to think of the Schmidt number in a more entropic way, this is the Reinian entropy of order 2 of this distribution. So the logarithm of k is the Reinian entropy of order 2. Now, this is concerned, the Schmidt decomposition gives us the state that is generated. But we need to detect these higher order modes, and we need to be sure of detecting in the right basis. If you think of it, if a party or a detector detects one photon, then the amount of shared information that it has with the other detector, the other party, depends on which basis they're looking at. In fact, I can depict each of the Schmidt modes as these non-overlapping circles. And I can do the same with a detection basis. Now, if I use, for instance, this detection basis to measure that generated state, then if I get a click from this mode, for instance, I cannot determine which of these three modes it was coming from. So, and that is some information which has been lost. So what we want to do is to move the detection basis on top of the generation basis, of the Schmidt basis, which means that we have to look at the generated state with the Schmidt modes. So let's start with the most coarse approximation, which is to approximate the sync function with the Gaussian. It's not a very good approximation, but it works well if we want to make some points. For instance, one of the things that one of the nice things that follows from taking this approximation is a very convenient and neat closed form for the Schmidt number. Here, you can think of sigma as the size of the pump beam, and B is the length of the crystal. And it's remarkable how only these two parameters are involved. Now, K is very large for, if we fix a beam size, K is very large for very thin crystals or for very large crystals, but employing very large crystals is expensive here the minimum is for B sigma equal to 1, in which case the state is separable because K is 1. If B sigma equal to 1. But to have B sigma equal to 1 with a normal laser beam means having a crystal of meters, which is unfeasible. So we are really interested mainly in the limit for short crystals. Now, people think that this is a drawback, and in a way it is, because it's basically telling that the shorter the crystal, the more entanglement you have. But also, the shorter the crystal, the less light you get out of it. So it's a trade-off. But we will see in a moment that this is a feature only of this approximation, that in reality, what happens is a bit different. Now, a question that we should ask ourselves is, what is the expression in this case, which is really what the phase matching function is? And I will come also to that. Now, if we use this expression, we can plot the number of shared bits between the photons as the limit for alpha that goes to 1 of the Rennie entropy, which then tends to the Shannon entropy. You see that for 1, for B sigma equal to 1, the state is separable. And the actually, the amount of entanglement grows really fast as the thickness of the crystal decreases. So one other thing that can be studied with the Gaussian approximation is what happens if I have a non-ideal detector. Now, non-ideal detection can happen for many reasons. You can have crosstalk between the channels, you can have light coming from other sources, you can have dark counts, you can have turbulence which affects the state, and other reasons. But when these causes were studied, it was always assumed that the detector is capable of detecting any mode. But this is, in general, not true. So what we did was to assume that we have imperfect detectors that cannot possibly see part of the modes. So here, for instance, we have a detector that cannot see 25% of the modes. This detector cannot see half of the modes, and this one cannot see 3/4 of the modes. But because of this and of the relation between shared bits and number of modes, we can see that if we have a highly entangled state, so if we move to the right here, then the fraction of shared bits which are still detected actually tends to 1 for k that tends to infinity. So for instance, if we have a very bad detector which just cannot see half of the modes, then we can still detect 80% of the shared bits for 20 modes. If we want to push it to 90%, we have to go up to 500 modes, but this is not difficult. 500 modes, it's doable, especially if one considers hyper entanglement, so mixing temporal part with spatial part. However, the phase matching function is not a Gaussian, it's a sync function. So what happens if, instead of using the Gaussian, we use the sync? Well, we can start answering this question by taking only the subspace of P equals zero. So we are not, for the moment, concerned with modes with more rings. And something nice happens. There's a surprise here. So this is well, you can think of this as the thickness of the crystal. And this is the number of modes. Now, the red line is the number of modes with P equals zero that are produced by the source. Sorry, all modes that are produced by the source. These two lines are the number of modes that we can see. And as everyone thought, if we use the Gaussian, we start losing modes as soon as the crystal start to become thicker. But actually, if we use the sink, we can see that there is a certain zone here where we can pick thicker crystals without losing modes. Then we start to lose modes. But this is an indication that we have some space to move freely and buy more expensive, yes, but thicker crystals that generate more light. Just to give you some numbers, crystals range from 1 to 5 millimeters, maybe 10 millimeters for the thickest ones, and a number of hundreds of thousands of entangled pairs per second can be created. But, however, we should include higher radial modes too, because right now we just use the P equals zero subspace. So if we do that, we get a more general relation between this parameter and the number of modes that are created, which is the green line. The dashed line is the same, is k calculated with the Gaussian approximation. So we do in reality get more modes. And we can heuristically modify that simple and nicely looking law by just introducing a parameter here, alpha. And if numerically we try to use alpha 0.65, then we can match very well the behavior of this new number of modes as a function of B sigma. We can make it work also for values of B sigma that are bigger than one, but it doesn't really make sense because no one has experiments with B sigma bigger than one. And we would need two parameters instead of one, which is unnecessary. So we just introduce one parameter, and then we can tell how many entangled modes there are as a function of B sigma in a more accurate way. I remind you that this dashed line was the previous law. Okay, but the photons can be phase mismatched. So the main in Fourier space in K space, we can see rings, for instance, and we can open and close the down conversion cone by tilting the crystal or changing its temperature. So how do we deal with that? Well, we have to do it numerically. But another nice surprise is to be found. Now this is a graph with the Schmidt weights of the Schmidt decomposition. So that we basically tells us that it's more likely to detect an L equals zero and P equals zero mode than a higher order mode. But the width of this distribution is basically tells us how much entanglement there is. And we can find, for instance, here 332 modes. If we introduce some mismatch here, for instance, it's this is the, just a numerical factor that goes into the sink. So the sink opens up. We have darkness in the center, rings outside. And here the distribution of the L values is much wider. And we can increase the entanglement about twofold. But what really is interesting is the shape of the Schmidt modes. And this is the title, The Hidden Structures, which were hidden because we were using the some coarse approximations and we couldn't see them. So if we look at the Schmidt modes, then this is the intensity of that corresponds to this phase mismatch. So there is basically nothing in the center, a big ring outside, and some secondary rings. Now here, every line here is the intensity of a Schmidt mode. This is the center of the beam. So this zero here corresponds with this point here. And as we move to the right, we are moving to the right here. You can see that this each of these rings, this is a ring, this is a bright ring, this is a not so bright ring, and so on, is going to be filled by a family of modes. And they look like Hermite Gauss modes, more or less. This is the first order, second order, third order, fourth order, etc. But as we label them with a radial quantum number p, they jump from one ring to the other as soon as the intensity that I have filled up makes it lower than the neighboring ones. So we are proposing a splitting of the radial number p into two quantum numbers, one that labels the ring and one that labels the mode in the ring. But perhaps what is most interesting is that the modes are confined in the rings. It is like there is some symmetry which we didn't take into account that prevents a photon from existing in two rings. So basically from it prevents entanglement between rings, if you will. And this is interesting, and it's a very recent result, and we just submitted it, so we need to think a bit more about it. But it certainly is some new feature that might be bearing potential benefits. And if I just plot the first three, they really look like Hermite Gauss modes. But Hermite Gauss modes in a strange way, in the sense that this is the center of the beam, so these are really ringed modes, structure in the radial coordinate looks like Hermite Gauss modes. Right. So now let's get to the cool stuff. This is an experiment that was done in Glasgow by the quantum optics group. They violated Bell's inequalities in a higher dimensional space. Tumisa Dada, it's a brilliant radical scientist at Harriet Watt University, and he came up with this higher dimensional version of Bell's inequalities. And given that the down conversion source can create these highly entangled states, they could violate Bell in a 12 dimensional space. So down conversion and down conversion experiments can be a way of testing quantum mechanics. This is something that we did in Leiden University. These are phase plates. They are a way to address orbital angular momentum and orbital angular momentum states. And the way they work is that they, depending on which, so this is a phase plate where if a field goes through this part, it goes, nothing happens, and it gets pi shifted if it goes through the other side, the other type of slices. These are optimized plates. So for n sectors, they can access the maximum number of modes. So this is a way to address these vast Hilbert spaces of orbital angular momentum. This was a theoretical paper, numerical results, which recently the same quantum optics group in Glasgow University put into practice. And here we measure. So this is the number of modes, the dimensionality of the Hilbert space that those phase plates can access. So at some point, they will saturate the generation bandwidth. So the generation of the number of modes that are created. And this happened around here, and then we can infer that there were almost 50 OEM modes. But another important property of OEM modes and entanglement in OEM is that they can propagate very well through a turbulent atmosphere. And this is important for possible applications like for communication purposes. Here they claim that scaling up our system to real-life dimensions, a horizontal propagation distance of 2 kilometers seems viable. And this still maintaining high-dimensional entanglement. This is very recent, a couple of weeks ago. Leiden University, Wolfgang Loeffler, demonstrated a number of spatial modes of 10 to the 4, which means about 13 bits of shared entanglement. So these are a lot, I mean, these are kind of big numbers if one thinks that they can combine them with temporal entanglement. So to conclude, this is one of my favorite. It's possible to post-select on the states. And there are some particular superpositions of weighted superpositions of Lagrange-Gauss modes, which give these knots. Here the knots are knots of phase singularities. So what is knotted is the dark part of the field. And since we have a very large Hilbert space, we can post-select and just keep the entangled knots. So what they did is that they violated Bell with these entangled knots of light, of darkness. And this is, in a way, another hidden structure, if you will, in the unconverted light. So to summarize, high-dimensional spatial entanglement of thousands of modes has been reached. And it's relatively easy to produce, control, and measure, especially because it's easy to work with light. You don't need vacuum. You don't need low temperatures, etc. And if combined with high-dimensional temporal entanglement, it can yield a vast Hilbert spaces to play with. Downconversion still has some mysteries, which could bear potential further benefits. One of the things that could come out of those properties of the Schmidt modes that I just showed was that it's maybe an indication that there could be some super selection-like super-selection-like behavior of the modes. And so maybe it's possible with down conversion to implement in a direct way super-selection as a resource. And there is a lot of room to play with tests of quantum mechanics and implementations of quantum information protocols, communications, and also cryptography. And with that, I thank you. And happy to answer any questions.
Mm-hmm. On the second to last slide where you had the knots, can you describe physically again what this is represented, and also what is the sort of the disk?
Okay, so yeah, the disk is so if you this is a three-dimensional structure. If you cut the plane where the disk is and you represent phase with colors, then you get that that structure. And if you see in this point, you have a phase singularity as all the colors wind around. And so in the center, the phase is not defined. There's a phase singularity there. And the same happens here, there, and there. And you can have a three-dimensional structure of this sort. And if you follow the phase singularity, they close in loops. And these loops can be linked. So you can have knots. You can have links.
OK.
So how do you measure? You said it's
close to that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you basically measure in the basis that you know that will give you this structure.
Which is
it's a superposition of not many 5 or 6 Lagrange-Gauss modes. But the fact that there are so many available, it makes it possible to create these entangled structures.
So, I mean, for that very last point about doing other kinds of quantum information protocols with this, What's the range of measurements you can do on these states?
The range of measurements meaning?
Well, like what observable hold basically. Oh,
okay.
Measure. I mean,
well,
so say
okay.
you want to do like
mm-hmm.
some very high dimensional Bell inequality
yeah.
tests.
Well, there are two special observables depending on which basis, which family of solutions of the paraxial Helmholtz equation one is choosing. And then there are other two, frequency and time in the temporal part. And then there are also another two polarizations. So in total, five observables, I would say.
Okay, which is still much less than the dimensionality you're working with.
Oh, yeah.
So
but the number of modes is, I mean, some of these observables
have many outcomes. Right?
Yeah, they have many outcomes. That's yeah.
You mentioned that it's robust to turbulence.
Mm-hmm.
Is it more so than polarization? Like, is there a reason why
orbital
is more robust?
Well, I think it depends on the noise model as well. But I would say that one of the reasons is that phase singularities it's difficult to kill them in a way. So you know, you have this phase structure which propagates, and you can have like conditions in which the modes become bigger and smaller, but that doesn't matter for orbital angular momentum. So I think it's a strength of the fact that orbital angular momentum is a well-behaved observable, which, you know, it's well-defined only the direction of propagation, because you can think of the separation between spin and orbital angular momentum. And together they form the total angular momentum, which is the generator of rotations. But you can really separate them only the direction of propagation, because the spin part generates rotations of the polarization. But you cannot rotate the polarization in the direction of propagation, because that would give you an physical field. So if you use the spin orbital angular momentum, sorry, the spin angular momentum, you on a vector field, then every point, every arrow will rotate about the point where it originates. But if you use the orbital angular momentum, then every point will rotate, but they will keep their direction of polarization. If you use both of them, then you rotate everything like with the total angular momentum. But you can do this only in the direction of propagation.
Do you know how these modes behave under Lorentz boots?
Lorentz
boots.
Yeah, but what the
the angular or by the orbital angular momentum.
Well, then you have to use the higher. I mean the orbital angular momentum is a three vector, so you need to use the six component tensor in that case.
So, but they only mix with each other.
They mix. It still only works in the direction of propagation.
Sure, right, and which is obviously speed of light.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you.